joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program we discuss problems and other issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all, supplemented by scientific data and facts. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today we will be continuing our discussion on the mistake number 15 that some parents make when raising their children, and that was not sufficiently respecting our children and in turn not inspiring self-confidence and self-esteem in them. We discussed how detrimental this can be to their development, and today we'll be talking about how do we then, as parents, grow this confidence in our children. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه When it comes to our children and making sure that we give them self-confidence and grow confidence into them there are a number of things that we have to keep in mind We'll try our best to cover most of them today episode, if not, inshallah, in other episodes. One of the first things that we have to do, which is actually a right of a child over his father, and this is according to the hadith from the Prophet, and we have the same thing from Imam Sajjad in Risalat al-Huquq. He says, "An yuhsina ismu."
Choosing a good name.
You have to choose a good name. A name has a huge effect on the person and on his personality, and plays a major role. Even psychology today, they have succumbed to this fact that the name of a child has a lot of effect on him.
Right.
So choosing a beautiful name, like, you know, the Prophet, he said, the best of names, that which is Muhammad or Ubud, that which is a form of a glorification or worship to Allah, be it something with Ahmed, Muhammad, or no, Abdurrahman, Abdul Ghafur, or the names of the holy imams, or a name at least that can leave an impact on the child himself.
So an Islamic name, in short.
Obviously an Islamic name, but I mean, even for those who are not Muslims, there are names that are really stupid names. And sometimes there are names that are weird in their nature, and names and their nature, they are even sometimes could be a curse word, or swearing word.
Right.
You don't want to name your child that name. So
obviously,
with different difference of language, each language has the meaning of different words. So you have to make sure that you choose a nice, beautiful name for your child.
Right.
And not call him random names. Because I've heard, especially within the Muslim world, we have such an imaginative minds when it comes to naming our children.
Right. And the very of the best names, creative minds on earth.
Exactly. And some of the names, they make absolutely no sense.
Right.
And sometimes kids are named under animal names, and sometimes kids under objects, which is, you know, that obviously not going to help the child have a self-esteem. Rather, it will do the opposite.
Right, and with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upping. Today we are discussing how we can grow confidence in our children, first step being choosing for them a good and virtuous name. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
The second thing that we have to keep in mind when it comes to trying to grow confidence in our children is that the mothers, at a young age, especially when the child is an infant and he's a suckling child, that they have to give him enough love and enough emotions and, you know, constantly looks at him, constantly talks to him, constantly smiles in his face. So he feels that he's connected to something and to someone.
Right.
And obviously needs to keep him away from loud noises and arguments, because sometimes we argue right in front of our children.
Right.
That does not help them. That actually makes them a lot weaker. That lowers their self-confidence.
Right.
So it's important that the child gets a source of emotional support from his mother, or at least from his father, if the mother is not available.
So that they get a support line, an emotional support line.
Exactly.
That they always have.
Exactly. So they have what we call lifeline when it comes to their personality and to their development emotionally, and having the confidence being at its peak, or at least in its growing phases.
Right.
So the child needs to have that at this stage. And also when it comes to the child, you know, even through breastfeeding and teaching,
right,
and trying to, you know, nurture that child. And they also say that argument and fighting around a child in this age, it forces them, it puts them in a state of stress,
right,
that they will just keep drinking mentally. So,
of course,
we see that kids... who are obese, one of the cases of obesity is actually stress.
Stress eating. Yeah,
stress eating. So especially with kids who are obese, they have this stress eating only because, for example, there's a lot of arguments in the house. There's a lot of fights in the house. They don't have that emotional support line. So they end up eating and drinking too much.
Right.
And their self-confidence is always at its lowest. So we need to do the opposite. So if the child is eating or drinking or breastfeeding, make sure the environment is quiet. Make sure there are no argument. Make sure there's nothing happening just in order to increase.
So provide a safe environment also.
Exactly, just to make sure that the child is in the same environment,
right,
where he can grow. And
healthily.
Health-wise and safely, and his confidence grows naturally. And also when it comes to the mother, for example, playing with the child as well, giving him plenty of play time, giving him plenty of lap time, keeping him constantly around you, showing him that you care, taking him from one place to another. So all these things will increase the child and make the child feel that he's loved and wanted by his parents.
And with that in mind, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how we can inspire confidence in our children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So we were talking about how we can get children to have self-confidence, especially at a younger age. Now, one of the things that affects a child when it comes to self-confidence, especially at a young age, that when children cry, a lot of mothers, for example, either they ignore the child completely or they run to him quickly.
Right.
So we say there has to be something in between, that you don't carry him for every time that he cries, nor should you leave him when he cries.
All right.
So you have to make sure why is he crying, and I think we've been through this. I mean, is he hungry? Does he want to drink? I don't know. Does he need the diaper change? Is there something that's like an ant or a fly sitting on him and just bugging him? So we need to find the causes rather than just jumping to a solution. But nevertheless, the idea is when he feels there's someone around him, someone giving him that protection, someone that looking after his interests.
Well, he must feel safe then.
He feels safer. The safer he feels, the more his self-confidence will grow. So it's obviously is the opposite of fear when you feel that you are being neglected and there's no one around you. So sometimes if we overdo it and we spoil the child that every time he cries we run to him, obviously that will lower his self-esteem, not increase it.
Right. Because he cannot rely on himself perhaps to solve his problems and issues.
Exactly. And also I think among the things that we mentioned when it comes to hitting the child that will lower his self-esteem, the opposite would be to encourage the child every time he achieves a job.
Right.
Wherever he does, small or big, give him that encouragement that he requires. We need to encourage him for every action that he does, small or big. To us, it might sound insignificant, but to the child, it's quite significant.
Right.
And you see, the most capable people that we have in society today are the ones who were encouraged from a young age to do things, or for the things that they've done, even though they were meant to be so stupid. For example, with the artists or inventors or what have you, you see that the parents encouraged them when they did something that seemingly seemed to be stupid, but the child wasn't. And you see that has made a large impact. So it gave them that self-confidence to turn it into a skill and work with it.
And actually, we also have a real-life example of this. I unfortunately do not remember the name, but there is a very famous scientist who has contributed a lot to the scientific community.
Hmm.
All of the conditions set for him in life were pretty horrible. Like, if you saw this child, you would say he's not going to amount to anything.
Yeah.
But this very same scientist, he says, the unconditional love and support I had from my mother made me achieve this.
Exactly, exactly. I think that was Isaac Newton.
I forgot his name.
Who said that? He said it was the love of my mother.
Right.
That because he got kicked out of school because they said to her, he's too dumb.
Yeah.
So he went and he did. But he did what he did only because of the unconditional support and love that his mother gave him, so much self-confidence that he was able to create and invent the things that he did.
Of course, we would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Khyber continues to send shivers down the Zionist spine. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Hello everyone, and as for your information, the 24th of the month of Rajab was the anniversary of the immortal Battle of Khaybar, which was undertaken on divine commandment in the year 7 AH, corresponding to 629 AD, to end Israelite plots in Arabia by the last and greatest messenger of God, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we go into details, let us present you a famous statement that continues to be contemplated upon by the faithful until this day. Tomorrow I will give the banner of Islam to the valiant attacker who never retreats, who loves God and the Prophet, and in turn is loved by God and the Prophet. He will not return from the battlefield till God brings about victory by his hand. This is what the Messenger of Mercy, who never said anything but it was inspiration from God Almighty, as the Holy Quran testifies in the opening ayahs of Surah Najm, said on the eve of the memorable battle. It is found in all authentic Islamic texts of all denominations of Islam, whether Sunni or Shia Muslim. It refers to a crucial event in the history of Islam, and it is enlightenment of minds and souls in order to deliver humanity from the darkness of disbelief. These words, as some might misconstrue, do not speak of aggression, nor do they refer to any violent attacker trying to disturb peace. As a matter of fact, they speak of a determined endeavor to end mischief and ensure a lasting solution through a brave and valorous person for whom stepping back from what had been entrusted to him was out of the question. He is the one devoted to God and the Holy Prophet, and who in turn is endeared by both God and the Holy Prophet. He is none other than the Holy Prophet's dearest cousin, ward and son-in-law, and divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The Imam responded to the Prophet's call, and as the chosen of God, he led the Muslims to a brilliant victory, almost single-handedly, on the 24th of the month of Rajab, which to this day is reminiscent of his exploits and continues to inspire modern-day Muslims in the campaigns against the avowed enemies of Islam. It happened that the Israelite tribes who had settled in Khaybar, some 150 kilometers north of the city of Medina, were planning to attack the Prophet in a bid to wipe out Islam, although the ancestors of these very same people had migrated to Arabia from Palestine and Syria to await the coming of the last and greatest Prophet from among the cousins of the Ishmaelite Arabs, as foretold by Prophet Moses and the sacred scriptures. But when the universal mission of Islam was proclaimed in Mecca and the Islamic State founded in Medina by the Holy Prophet who was foretold in the Torah, only a handful of Jews recognized him to be the awaited emissary of God and became Muslims. While the rest of the Israelites denied his mission and ganged up with the pagan Arabs to try to kill him. It seems right from the advent of Islam, the Israelites and the faithless Arabs have secretly banded together, since they view as their common enemy Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This very same attitude persists until this day, as is evident by the recent establishment of ties with the illegal Zionist regime of Israel by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, with Saudi Arabia covertly supporting every such treasonous move. Because these rootless regimes are terrified of genuine Mohammedan Islam, regard the Islamic Republic of Iran as their common enemy, feel proud to be called American poodles, and fund terrorists to destabilize Muslim lands. It is worth noting that the people of Khaybar, who besides farming and raising sheep and cattle, were experts in industry and business, also enjoyed a monopoly of the armament industry at the time, especially after their ranks had been strengthened by the pact-breaking Banu Qaynuqa Jewish tribe, which was banished from Medina and was noted for its skills in metallurgy. The Jewish tribes viewed the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, signed a year earlier with the pagans of Mecca, as weakness on the part of the Prophet, and began to instigate the Arab tribes around Medina to attack the Muslims. The Jews of Khaybar ordered the Banu Qatafan Arab tribe to send raiding parties into the pastures around Medina. On one occasion, a son of the Prophet's famous companion, Abu Zar Ghaffari, was grazing camels when the pro-Jewish Arabs struck. They killed his good Muslim youth, captured his mother, who was with him, and drove with them the herd of camels. The Muslims, however, were able to overtake the Arab marauders and rescue the wife of Abu Zar Ghaffari. In view of these provocations, God commanded the Holy Prophet to mobilize Muslims for ending the sinister designs of the Jews of Khaybar, who had assembled a 10,000-strong army for a surprise attack on the city of Medina. The Prophet proceeded towards Khaybar and soon wrenched away from the central Jewish command several forts whose commanders accepted the amicable terms of peaceful existence offered by Islam. Qamus, the main fortress and the most impenetrable one, however, held out. Its commanders resorted to a war of attrition, launching raids and retreating to the safety of its ramparts, from where volleys of arrows continued to take their toll on Muslims. After several weeks of inconclusive encounters and disgraceful retreat by the Prophet's senior companions, who turned tail at the sight of the Jewish warlord, Marhab, and his battle prowess, the Prophet expressed the famous words that we presented to you at the beginning of the program regarding Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Thus, when the valiant man of God who was entrusted with command of the Muslim forces approached the impregnable fortress of Qamus, the Jewish warlord, who for days had put the companions of the Prophet to flight, thundered, "I am the fearsome warrior whose mother named me Marhab. All Khaybar knows a warrior bristling with arms when the war fiercely burns. I am the battle lion who's always victorious over his enemy." The answer this arrogantly ignorant warrior received from the Muslim commander stunned him. "I am the renowned lion. My mother named me Haydar. I weigh my foes in a giant balance." The moment he heard the word Haydar, a queer feeling overwhelmed Marhab. In a dream in his childhood, he had seen a lion tearing him to pieces. When he informed his mother, who was a soothsayer, he was told not to fight with anyone named Haydar. Now, on the battlefield, Marhab was in two minds, to fight or not to fight. He began to slowly turn his horse towards the fort and flee from the battlefield. But the devil's temptation, along with his own arrogance and blindness to see the realities of Islam, made the Israelite warlord intent upon fighting the command of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. As the eyes of the Muslim soldiers and the Jewish warriors were fixed upon him, the Israelite warlord suddenly attacked the Imam, who deftly evaded the flashing sword and struck Marhab with the matchless twin-bladed sword, Zulfaqar. To the surprise of the onlookers on both sides, the stroke of the Imam on the helmet of Marhab was so powerful that the Zulfaqar, after slicing the iron as if it was wood, cut his head into two and pierced through the body. In a moment, Marhab fell lifeless on the ground. The Imam's lightning blow was indeed the coup de grace for the fortress of Qamus, and as the Muslim soldiers, finding courage, rushed towards it to storm, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, again demonstrated his God-given strength by tearing apart from its hinges the heavy metal-encrusted gateway and threw it across the moat, in order to enable the Muslims to enter the castle. The Muslims now realized that it was not for no reason that the Prophet had said the day before, Nada Aliyan Mazhar al-Ajaib, which means, call Ali, the manifestation of wonders. Today, when the Arab regimes like their pagan ancestors are ganging up with the Zionists against Islam, it is only the path of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, as is being highlighted these days by the Islamic Republic of Iran and Lebanon's anti-terrorist movement Hezbollah, which is capable of defeating the modern-day Israelites and their satanic backers, as well as the devilish Takfiris. No wonder the Islamic Republic of Iran, as part of its legitimate means of defense to thwart the devilish designs of the despicable Zionists and their comrades in crime against humanity, has, by the grace of God, developed the sophisticated Khaybar Shekan missile, which is capable of shattering the so-called Iron Dome of the cowardly enemies.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, the Quran says, فَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ لِلدِّينِ حَنِيفًا فِطْرَةَ اللَّهِ الَّتِي فَطَرَ النَّاسَ عَلَيْهَا لَا تَبْدِيلَ لِخَلْقِ اللَّهِ ذَلِكَ الدِّينُ الْقَيِّمِ وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ Verse 30 and chapter 30. Now, this verse of the Holy Quran is about the God-gifted nature or the God-gifted instinct, fitra, that God has bestowed upon men. The translation of the verse which I just recited is, then set your face upright for the religion in the right state, the nature made by Allah in which He has made men. There is no altering of Allah's creation. That is the right religion, but most people do not know. Dear brothers and sisters, Allah Almighty has created man in a manner that he becomes aware of the right religion and has a strong affinity towards it. Now, we are going to focus a little bit on the term fitra. The term fitra means a God-given quality in all human beings. Now, innate matters are of two kinds, knowledge and desire. Okay, we have knowledge and we have desire. These are two innate matters that are inborn and that they are intrinsic. So, man's natural instinct consists partly of knowledge and partly of desire. That is for sure. You will not find anyone who does not have wishes and desires. And these desires are a part and parcel of every individual's life. So we can say that every person, through his innate God-given knowledge and desire, is instinctively aware of the pure religion and has an affinity towards it. But when a person is immersed in material life, or he is over-indulgent, or maybe he is living his ordinary lives and immersed in those ordinary affairs and does not pay attention to non-material ideas, his fitra, you know, his innate knowledge or his, God-given nature and desire will become clouded to some extent, or maybe to a large extent. We know that proper nourishment is necessary for the growth of the body. Our body needs food, nutrition, and everything that is necessary for its growth, of course. If we neglect the right type of diet, for example, it could lead to different kinds of complications that could cause function in the body. Imagine, you can see in poorer countries, people who are suffering from malnutrition. They have a lot of health complications, a lot of problems. This is quite natural because the body needs food, the body needs proper diet, you know, proper intake. That is essential. Now, it is the same with fitra. If we just indulge in material life, the other side will be weakened or clouded by material affairs. It is overwhelmed, you know. But in difficulties, of course, when our attention to the material life is, you know, temporarily diverted, we turn entirely to Allah and slowly begin to feel the change from inside. You know, in this state of helplessness, I gave you the example of a man who was on a ship, you know, and his ship was about to sink. The explanation that was given by Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, that the man thought of a supreme being, of God, the omnipotent. So even though he did not believe in God, but when he thought of that supreme being, Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam said that that being is God. In the state of helplessness, imagine in the situation where a person is about to sink, money, wealth, whatever you have accumulated in your life is of no use. They are not going to help you. You know, your parents, your brothers and sisters and all these things, your beautiful house or maybe your beautiful cars are going to be of no use to you. You are not going to take recourse to such things. You are not going to seek help, of course. So in difficulties and miseries or in the state of helplessness, we focus our attention to Allah. We direct our attention. We turn entirely to Allah and feel, you know, that there is someone superior, that there is someone who is more supreme and that he can help us. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Besides the physical body, there is a divine element or a spiritual element in the human being. What does that divine spirit mean? Does it mean that Allah has a spirit and has part of it in humans? Definitely not. When we attribute spirit to Allah, it is something symbolic, just like the house of Allah. Although everything is created by Allah, some things are more precious and respected than others, so we attribute them to Allah. One of which is, of course, the spirit, and of course it is symbolic. We can conclude that all men have a divine element in them, which is very important and which makes man a worthy being, which makes him superior to other creatures. Breathing life into Adam means instilling the divine spirit into him and Adam. That nafkh means blowing breath and life and spirit into the human body. This spirit or soul is the origin and the source of all special and exclusive perfections of human beings. All the capabilities of this species originate from this endless and everlasting source, the divine spirit. Therefore, all of us are indebted to Almighty Allah, the Creator, for this great blessing. And of course, let's also understand that it's not only spirit. We are distinguished from other creatures by the intellect, by the faculty of intellect that God has bestowed upon us. Let's also note that man was not created haphazardly, through chance. Man was created by Allah, and that God created human beings with a purpose, and then God has chosen human beings as his vicegerents. These are the important points and the major points that we must remember. Number one, God has created human beings first, Number two, God has created human beings with a purpose. And number three, God has chosen human beings as his vicegerents. And these three facts prove that humans are chosen to be Allah's representative on this earth, above all other creatures. You know, the Quran says, ثُمَّ سَوَّاهُ وَنَفَخَ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِهِ وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَ قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ. Now this verse 9 of chapter 32. Now I will give you the translation. Then he made him complete and breathed into him, وَنَفَخَ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِهِ, into him of his spirit, and made for you the ears and the eyes and the hearts. Little is it that you give thanks. So, قَلِيلًا مَا تَشْكُرُونَ. We human beings are not thankful to Allah for all the blessings that God has given to us. The faculty of intellect is not a simple blessing. The spirit that God has invested, that has placed inside us, is not a simple blessing. These are the most important blessings that Allah has placed in us. These are inborn things, you know, and these are the things which distinguish man from other creatures. Of course, there are more and more verses to be discussed, to be mentioned. I would suffice to this much. For the sake of brevity, our time is up. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah knows.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
communique.
According to the United States, Vladimir Putin should have invaded Ukraine by now several times. For the past weeks, we've heard nothing but hysteria from Western officials and media, claiming that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent. So where is it? Now, officially, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Nevertheless, it does enjoy considerable NATO support. The U.S., U.K., and others have said that they are ready to stand firm with Ukraine and help it face Russian aggression. Other countries, like France and Germany, have sought a softer, nuanced approach, preferring diplomacy with Russia over sending weapons to Ukraine. So what is happening between Russia and Ukraine? Is Putin really going to invade? Multiple Russian officials, including the president, have said no. Russia will not invade Ukraine. On the other hand, U.S. intelligence has claimed that an invasion would take place on several dates. Well, those dates have come and gone, and we've seen nothing of the sort. Yet if you listen to the news, you would think World War III was about to break out. Well, is it? Let's try and answer that question. Why exactly are there tensions between Russia and Ukraine? What are Russia's security concerns with NATO expansion, and are they legitimate? Is Putin really the malfeasant the West claims he is? Why is the United States backing Ukraine? What does it stand to gain? And does this crisis perhaps have more to do with Germany and Nord Stream 2 than it does with Ukraine and the Donbass region? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. We've been hearing for several months now that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is imminent. The media keeps saying that there are 100,000 Russian troops on Ukraine's border, meaning the Russian troops are in Russia. There's constant reports of shelling back and forth. And just the other day, the Russians evacuated civilians from Donetsk. But this media frenzy about an impending Russian invasion is really something. No one loves war more than the corporate media. And just to give you an idea how ridiculous it is, here are some of the claims that they made. First, they said that Putin will invade Ukraine on February 16th. They even had a date. And then they said it's February 16th at 3 a.m. And then on the evening before the supposed invasion, when Russia actually began withdrawing troops from its border with Ukraine, despite this, the lies continued. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan claimed that a Russian invasion was imminent.
And an invasion could begin, a major military action could begin by Russia in Ukraine any day now.
U.S. President Joe Biden said that he is sure that Putin has made the decision to invade.
And do you have any indication about whether President Putin has made a decision on whether to invade? Do you feel confident that he hasn't made that decision already?
As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision. We have reason to believe that.
U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken even went to the United Nations Security Council to give a speech and warn the world of this impending Russian invasion. Even Blinken himself, he knew that it's not the best look to be sitting in the exact same seat as Colin Powell was 19 years ago, lying to the world to start a war in Iraq.
Some have called into question our information, recalling previous instances where intelligence ultimately did not bear out.
The U.S. says it suspects Russia will stage a false flag attack at some point in order to justify an invasion. Russia also says the same thing about Ukraine, and it looks like that might have happened. On February 17th, there was a report that a Ukrainian kindergarten had been shelled in Stanitsa Luhanska. While the Western media are saying that it was Russian-backed separatists, let's take a closer look at the photographs. And we can see a hole in the wall, which was apparently caused by a shell. But if you look to the left, the windows are intact. All the glass is still there. And if we look inside the classroom, there are still footballs on the shelf right next to the hole. So let me get this straight. This shell was so powerful, it was able to make a hole in the wall, but the glass right next to it is unshattered. You know, I'm not a physicist, but I have felt a blast before, and the first thing to go are the windows. So something looks fishy. And nevertheless, regardless of whether this was a Ukrainian or a Russian false flag, this entire crisis is manufactured. Now, many in the West, they make the argument that Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine in 2014 and annexed Crimea, and therefore he'll do it again. He's a hazard, he's a danger, and he poses a risk. Well, let's look at 2014 and what happened between Russia and Ukraine. I want to bring on Alexander McKay. He's the co-host of the Red Star Radio, a podcast that gives a Marxist perspective on economics, political issues, finance, and history. Alex, thank you for coming on the program. We really appreciate having you. What do you say to people who have legitimate concerns about Russia, who say that, well, Russia annexed Crimea, Putin just expelled the deputy U.S. ambassador, Russia says it's withdrawing troops from its border with Ukraine, but then the U.S. and NATO can't verify that. So, you know, who are we to believe? And what you make of what happened in 2014? What actually happened in 2014? And tell us perhaps how it relates to the current situation.
That was, a culmination of a process that had gone on since Ukrainian independence, which was that the Ukrainian oligarchy was unable to actually build a real nation, a solid nation, following the dissolution of the USSR, which, by the way, most Ukrainians voted against the dissolution of the USSR in a referendum back in 91, but that's background, really. But we get to this point because there was not just the coup in 2014, there was an attempted Orange Revolution 10 years before, which the US was heavily involved in, one of the first color revolutions that they were running. The US has been constantly intervening in Ukraine, as they did in Georgia before the 2008 war there, in order to absolutely make sure that they maintain influence over these former Soviet republics and that the Russian influence is minimized or pushed out entirely. And because of the Ukrainian oligarchy being so economically and politically weak, they have been sandwiched between the US, the Europeans on supposedly one side, and then the Russian influence on the other. And this has played out over and over again to the point where in 2014, you had Yanukovych, the elected president, was looking to get out of the severe economic difficulties which Ukraine had incurred after the crash in 2008 by trying to sign a deal with the EU, which was strongly encouraged by Washington. But as with all of the EU's deals, it was so onerous with regard to the economic conditions that it would impose on Ukraine that even Yanukovych, who was a very corrupt man, but he was the elected president, balked at it and felt he would be unable to carry out the cuts in living standards for the ordinary Ukrainians demanded by the EU without facing significant instability. So he flips and signs a deal with Russia because Putin offered slightly better terms to him. And then, of course, then you get the reaction, which was a combination of many Ukrainians feeling entirely legitimately aggrieved that their nation was in this mess and it was run by a very corrupt elite. But that movement was captured by an organized group of extreme nationalists, hardcore right-wing, semi-fascist elements. They were able to seize control of it. And when Yanukovych fled, following an attempt at a negotiated deal that was sponsored by Putin, that then collapsed partly because the US, through people like the late Senator John McCain, Victoria Nuland, and various other operatives, were encouraging these far-right forces to keep going further and demanding more, taking more violent action in the street. And so this is how we got to the mess that we're in today.
We heard that Russia would be invading Ukraine on February 16th. The Sun even had a date and a time for us. They said 1 a.m. GMT on February 16th. Well, that has come and gone. No invasion. So what do you make of this whole, mainstream media hyping up this war? And now they're pushing the date back. They're saying it's going to be February 20th and so on.
Well, I think the shock that I felt, I'm sure you did as well, that a Murdoch paper would make an unreliable prediction. Who knew that was coming? But more seriously, the attempt at hyping this up over and over again, the attempt at essentially creating almost a synthetic war out of nothing, just shows you really that those involved in it, the US and the British governments principally, have chosen to make this a way of escaping their quite prodigious internal problems, I would say. What we have is obviously an ongoing situation in Ukraine that was at least in part caused by the US and British investment in a coup there in 2014. It's rumbled on ever since then with various attempts to resolve it through the Minsk Accords not working out because of the internal problems in Ukraine. And now we've come back to this idea of the Russians launching an imminent invasion. It's been imminent since about October last year. And the only, I think the principal reason why the US and the British keep returning to this and keep trying to amp this up is because it is a way for two embattled leaders, our prime minister and the US president, who are deeply unpopular, involved in all kinds of internal crises and scandals, to try and escape that, to try and reunify support around themselves. Then below that, you have all manner of motivations within the US, what's referred to the military-industrial complex, the intelligence agencies, and various other neoconservative freaks that hang around the Pentagon and the associated think tanks, who are just desperate to avenge themselves on Russia somehow, anyhow they can, and carry out some kind of long-cherished, insane dream that they're going to somehow restore Russia to the more weakened and chaotic state that it was in the 1990s.
You recently wrote on Twitter that, quote, in reality, the German ruling class have no interest in a war with Russia whatsoever, and this is just a desperate papering over the cracks in NATO. What do France and Germany actually want? Because we saw both the French president, Emmanuel Macron, and the German chancellor, Olaf Scholz, meeting with Putin, engaging in diplomacy, in dialogue. You know, Germany didn't seem too keen on sending Ukraine any weapons like the UK and the US. Why do you think they're acting differently from the US and the rest of Europe? Is there a rift, perhaps, in the NATO alliance?
Oh, yes. There's been a rift that's been developing, really, since Germany was reunited, which is that, and this is why it's part of the reason why our former Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, got into trouble and ultimately had to resign, because she was so opposed to German reunification, because she saw from the British ruling class's perspective that a reunited Germany would be too big and too powerful economically to be subjugated and controlled by Britain or the United States. And also, and this is what has happened certainly economically through EU membership, Germany has come to be the absolutely dominant economic player within Europe. Look at the huge benefits they've gained from Euro membership, for instance. Look at what they were able to do to Greece, for instance. And this contradiction lies in the problems that NATO is having, which is that the American position in Europe was dependent upon a divided Germany and all the nations of Europe being too weakened after World War II to essentially stand on their own. That's no longer the case. We no longer have the USSR there posing the threat that it used to capitalism. And so, therefore, all the tensions have erupted again. The Germans have a very extensive trading relationship with Russia that is very profitable for them. They got the other question of their own energy policy is now dependent upon getting gas from Russia. They can't have that compromised. Yeah. And so therefore, the French and the Germans don't have an interest in some kind of war in the east of Europe. The problem for the French is that they are now dependent upon a relationship with the Americans militarily in sub-Saharan Africa. But at the same time, they don't want a war in Europe. They are stuck because of Macron and his predecessor's policy of trying to retain control over former French colonies like Mali, where they've just been told to get out of. And they're now reliant on the American AFRICOM, America's colonial military operation in sub-Saharan Africa, to retain their influence there. That's a contradiction for them. The Germans can't get out from under, or don't want to get out from under, American military hegemony. But at the same time, they have very extensive trading ties they want to protect, not just with Russia, but also with China. So you've got all these tensions playing out. And in many ways, like the Americans and the British are desperately trying to paper over these cracks by saying, no, everything's fine, we're all united. But I'll bet, I don't know, but I'll bet that one of the things Macron and Scholz were saying to Putin was, we don't want